Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight is Seth Heasley. Seth, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
This is a little insider knowledge for people listening to this podcast, but I only screwed up Seth's name like 5 times before we recorded that. and yet you still are on the podcast, so I thank you for that. Seth, tell the people a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I am a podcaster, and of course I have had you on my most recent podcast, which is called Hugo's There, where we essentially do random Hugo. So I invite a guest on, and the guest chooses a novel off the list of Hugo winners, and we discuss it. And I also have another podcast called Take Me to Your Reader, where we discuss adapted science fiction. So science fiction movies that are adapted from novels or novellas, even short stories.
Oh, that's a rich field of discussion.
It very much is. Yeah, we have enough material to go for 20 years.
So what is, as you've, I assume you do some research for this to pick what you're going to talk about, what movie so far has been the most surprising that it was an adaptation of something else?
I'd probably go all the way back to the beginning. I did not know that The Day the Earth Stood Still was based on a short story.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Yeah. So I don't necessarily recommend listening to that on account it was the first episode.
had to work out some of the kinks.
And we've gotten better, I promise. So,
and that's a good movie, though. So don't listen to the podcast, but watch the movie.
Absolutely, yeah. Of course, we also, on that podcast, if there's remakes, we also discuss those.
Oh.
And, yeah.
Don't watch the remake.
I actually think that the Day the Earth Stood Still remake is a little underrated, but I still don't like it much. So.
But the original is better. Watch the original.
Definitely.
If you have time, I have seen the remake with Keanu Reeves. It's not awful, but it's kind of
It has problems.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where you're like, why did you remake this movie? I don't understand. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we're here to talk about Star Trek that does not have any of these problems because every episode of Star Trek is a gem.
Sure, yeah, and Star Trek has no remakes either.
So. No. There is a section of the fan community that does reject the fact that there are remakes, but we are not going to talk about remakes, and I'm not even going to tell people what we're going to talk about yet because I want to talk about you and your relationship with Star Trek. Would you consider yourself a Star Trek fan?
Yes, I definitely would. I grew up with Star Trek, the original series in syndication, watching it as a pretty young child in the late 70s, early 80s. And then when I was a freshman in high school, The Next Generation came out, and I was a huge fan of that. I kind of lost track of it, actually, after high school. Went to college, didn't have a television, and so I never really connected with Deep Space Nine, never connected with Voyager. Of course, never connected with Enterprise because people told me not to.
It was a conscious decoupling.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, back in junior high, high school, I would have considered myself a huge Star Trek fan. You know, I had the Enterprise D technical manual. I read a couple dozen of the TNG novels and several of the TOS novels as well. I think I had the Klingon dictionary at one point as well. So, yeah, I was a big fan back then. Now, you know, I still really like Star Trek.
You know, I find it fascinating that you didn't have a TV in college because I when I went to college, this has nothing to do with Star Trek, but I took very little of my possessions with me. But one thing I did take was a tiny color TV that I had, and I brought it with me, set it up in my dorm so I could watch stuff.
There were a couple guys in my dorm who had a television in their room, but most of my television watching was like with a bunch of other people in a common room. It just didn't happen to be when Star Trek was on. I always caught up with TNG in the summer when I went back home. But by the time I got out of college, I happened to marry a woman who is not a Star Trek fan. I know that's scandalous. But
it is.
So since it's not something that we watched together, it was not something that was watched. So
I understand
that's
that.
Why we never really watched Deep Space Nine or Voyager.
It is true.
And it's okay.
Luckily, my wife is a fan of Star Trek, so she likes to watch. Whatever we're watching, we are making our way through. Well, she's not waiting for me, but she is making her way through Deep Space Nine, and I pop in and out. But it is interesting when you are part of a couple – you have to kind of agree to what you're going to watch because so there are just shows that we cannot watch together, and there's only so many hours in the day, so you can't watch everything.
Yeah. I did. In the last year or so, I actually went back and watched Deep Space Nine on Netflix. So that was cool.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, now I have to ask. So you've watched Deep Space Nine, TNG.
I have.
TOS. What, and I'm assuming, well, I already know that you haven't seen much of Voyager, right. and we all know, Enterprise is to be avoided, except for the people who love it. I love you. Don't send me emails. which series would you say is your favorite?
It's definitely TNG. It's the one that came out that I watched when it was out. The original series I have a lot of affection for, but I've been going back and rewatching those episodes and realizing not a lot of them made that much of an impression on me. But yeah, it's TNG. I think I agree with you that overall Deep Space Nine is probably the better series, but I don't have that as much affection for it.
Well, and also I've been giving some thoughts to this theory. I think it is clear that Deep Space Nine is a better series, but it also has the benefit of coming later, so it has, yes, it benefits from, you know, this new idea at the time that TV could be serialized and that people could remember, you know, complicated stories.
Right.
And the TNG was really basically in the mold of the original series, right, where it was very episodic. The, yes, only kind of breakout, I mean, there are lots of differences between TNG and the original series, but the biggest one from kind of a story structure is that they had two-parters in TNG. They didn't have those in the original series. So,
right.
But I do, everyone who's listens to this knows that TNG is also my favorite series. So that leads me to believe that I have to ask you what your favorite character is from TNG.
Oh, okay. So if you had asked me this back when I was first watching it, I probably would have said Data. Mm-hmm. I always liked the science officer. My dad was a scientist, and so that was part of it. Plus, he was funny. I liked Worf as well because there was the fish out of water kind of thing there. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, on reflection and watching episodes back with my son now, I really like Riker. And I don't usually hear people say that. So
I was going to say, that is not what I would have guessed. So what about Riker? His beard?
I don't know. Yeah, definitely. I do have a beard. So, yeah, I like Jonathan Frakes' performance as Riker. I'm not sure that the character was always done right by the writers, but I just, you know, I like the fact that he's tall and commanding. I especially like when he interacts with either younger or more junior officers. So an episode like Below Decks, that was a good one for him. And I really like that there's that one episode that really features him, State of Mind, that I always thought was just a great performance.
Oh, yes. He's
Frame of Mind. Frame of Mind.
I'm horrible with titles, as everyone who listens knows. Riker is very avuncular, right? He is kind of the guy that Picard sends off to deal with troublesome crew members because Picard doesn't actually want to talk to anybody. And you know, because the thinking is they just basically split Kirk into two characters. Riker,
right,
got the man of action, kind of, you know, space, right, Lothario, although with consent, always consensual. Riker is all, yes, big into consent. Picard got the kind of the problem solving, diplomatic kind of half of Kirk. And you don't want to be, I've said this before, but if I were, I often, well, maybe not often, every once in a while, I imagine myself serving on the Enterprise as perhaps an ensign or something, because I don't want to get too ahead of myself. I imagine, you know, the turbo lift doors open, and who's standing there? Captain Picard. And I think to myself, maybe I'll just wait for the next turbo lift. I don't want to be alone with Captain Picard.
Yeah.
But if Riker were there, I feel like he'd know my name and he'd ask me some random question about something that he, like the specific thing he remembers about me. I feel, right, like that's the kind, yeah, of guy he is.
That's what I was going to say. He would ask you something you'd be surprised he knew about.
Exactly. I like that Riker. He's all right. Plus, mm-hmm, he sits in a chair weirdly. So that's always fun.
Yes. He even stands a little weirdly, a little off kilter. I always noticed that.
And I think I've said this countless times, but Jonathan Frakes' father was my college advisor. So he gets 2 points for that.
Very nice.
Yes. But enough about me and enough about TNG. We did not. The random Trek computer that I have stationed in a secret moon base that beams down the random selections to me did not pick a TNG episode for you because it knows that you like TNG, so right. It likes to broaden your Star Trek mind, I suppose. It picked a Voyager episode.
Yes.
A second season Voyager episode, which, you know, who knows? Late in the season, though, episode 23, mm-hmm. season 2, as I said, The Thaw, which... I don't know. Well, you know, they tried to do something, and I appreciate the effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't sure what to hope for, actually. To hope for that we'd get, like, a beloved TNG episode or TOS episode or something from Deep Space Nine that I'd just recently seen. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of glad that it picked something that I hadn't seen before. And definitely, I had not seen this before.
Well, that's good. I usually do not do this. But I will say, I think this episode is fine. It's not like my favorite episode. It's not the worst episode ever. I think it has issues. But I do believe that the ending of this episode is spectacular. The last,
I agree.
Like, minute of this episode, fantastic.
Yes, definitely.
And worth watching the entire thing, because it doesn't make any sense if you just watch the last minute. So worth watching entire thing to get to that last scene, because that last scene, man,
yeah,
that's good.
Definitely.
But it doesn't start with the last scene, oddly enough. No. So let's talk about Voyager in general before we jump into this episode, though. So you haven't seen much Voyager.
No. In fact, prior to watching this one, I had literally seen the premiere episode and the finale, the series finale.
An interesting way
to go. I
just
happened to be at my sister's house when it was on. And so we stayed for it. And yeah, that's it. And I just kind of felt like, okay, well, I've seen Voyager.
You've seen the two bookends. What do you need?
Yeah, exactly. Well, so I know where everybody ends up, so.
Well, there you go. And I will say, Voyager, I started off in this podcast not having seen a huge amount of Voyager, although more than you have.
Yes.
And I have come to appreciate Voyager, specifically Captain Janeway, because I really like Captain Janeway. I also like the Doctor, although I don't really like the first couple season Doctor, although he plays a very critical role in this.
Yes.
And
I do like him in this one.
He is good. And I don't, I have a well-known aversion to Harry Kim. Not a fan of Harry Kim, although he's fine in this episode. This is a Harry Kim episode, really. And it's fine. Tom Paris, not a fan of, but he's in this for like 2 seconds. So doing his kind of space frat boy thing that he does. And everybody else. I mean, Captain Janeway is fine. Neelix doesn't do anything, really. So that's my character check-in at this point. The most annoying characters that I dislike don't do much in this episode. Even Harry Kim doesn't bother me, although Janeway has the best moments in this episode.
Yes, definitely. And now, can you tell me, does Tuvok always look like he's fighting a really bad headache?
Yes, he does. And he is, okay. He's just sad that they have squandered his character, the writers. So he's just angry that he doesn't do anything.
Nice.
Because I think Tuvok is Chakotay, is did you say Tuvok or Chakotay?
No, one? I said Tuvok.
Okay, Tuvok.
Not Chakotay. I have no questions about Chakotay.
You have no questions? That's the problem with Chakotay. Nobody has any questions for him. yeah, Tuvok is, he's a grumpy Vulcan, and that's why we like him. He's just hanging out there. He doesn't do much in this episode either, except apparently have a mild headache.
Yeah, and he kind of kicks off the plot, right? It's his idea.
Oh, that's true. He does suggest that they can beam down there or beam them. So, yeah, I have problems with this episode.
I have a lot of problems with certain aspects of this.
So why don't we just jump into it before we've been talking around it, mostly because
Sounds
of
good.
Me. So we start. It doesn't really matter. The Stinger really is what Harry Kim is playing as oboe or something. I'm not a
clarinet,
musical.
Clarinet, I think.
Clarinet. There you go. Oh, he wants to date a woman who plays an oboe.
Right, and so does Tom Paris.
And it's hijinks ensue, and you think, oh, gosh, is this going to be an episode where they're going to go to the holodeck to try to woo a lady? Luckily, it is not.
No.
although they do, so Tom, what's his name? Harry Kim is practicing his clarinet, and the person next door bangs on the wall, and I thought to myself, those walls must be very thin. And as soon as I thought that, they explained that there's fluid running through the walls and that it conducts sound. And I thought, all right, Voyager, I'll give you that. But then I thought, that little tidbit is going to be important for the story, and it is not.
No, it is not, and it makes no sense whatsoever.
It also makes no sense. It's true.
Like, living quarters, fundamentally, when you're putting a ship together, I mean, you got to be able to have soundproof walls.
Yes, and he wasn't even playing that loudly, so
no,
it makes
he wasn't.
Me feel like they are very shoddily made walls.
No, he was playing pretty nicely, though, and it looked like the actor was actually playing, so...
Yes, so good on him. Mm-hmm. And this is when we get, you know, Harry says, I'm practicing because whatever, some lady is, we're going to do a duet. I do find it interesting that so many Starfleet officers play musical instruments and there are so many recitals. Certainly on TNG, there was like a recital every week.
Yes, with people not actually playing violins.
That's right. Very poorly pretending that they're playing.
Yeah,
and so Tom Paris talks about, oh, I've been chasing her for 6 months, and Harry Kim says something about, you know, the way to her heart is her oboe.
Yes.
But then, luckily, thankfully, they're interrupted.
Yes, we are rescued from that that train of thought.
That's right, because they found this planet that has satellites around it, but oh no, it looks like everybody died because of some kind of solar flare.
Yes,
and 400. I don't know how they realized that 400,000 people were there. I guess they could scan the bodies.
I can't remember if that was a tidbit from Neelix, because he was familiar with the planet.
Yes. Neelix is like, oh, this used to be a great trading post.
And 400,000 is not at all a large population for an entire planet.
No. So it's apparently a colony. So I guess nobody, they didn't bother to, or maybe their home planet already knows. I don't know. It's very unclear. But all we know is 19 years ago, 400,000 people died because of the solar flare, and it screwed up their satellites. But, they're being hailed from the surface. And then cut to the credits. Not the credits, the intro. Mm. And so you're like, oh, who's hailing them? Ghosts from this dead planet? and it turns out that kind of, yes.
Yeah, in a way.
Because their sensors have tripped this automated recording that some dude has left that basically says, hello, if you're hearing this, you know that we're all dead. But we're not all dead. Some of us are in stasis chamber underneath the surface. Please do not interrupt us, because our finely tuned machinery is going to wake us up exactly 14 years after this disaster, so we can start populating the planet again and fix everything.
I thought it was interesting that he gave the detail of how long that they planned to be down, because that's the only way they can figure out that they're overdue.
Right. Otherwise, the story, they're like, okay, well, let's leave.
Yeah.
But yeah, we know now that it's 5 years overdue, because somehow they managed to, I guess with sensors and science, who knows, managed to figure out that it happened exactly 19 years ago. So they should have woken up 5 years ago, but they didn't. And this is when, now I haven't, this is the first time I've seen this episode. So I just assumed that at this point we would be beaming down to the planet.
I also did.
And that is not what happens.
No, not at all. I also thought it was fascinating that Harry Kim's sensors are acute enough to tell that there's no life signs on the planet, which a planet is round. And so the sensors can evidently reach the other side by going around, not through.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't penetrate the actual planet surface and go below ground.
Yes.
Until he recalibrated it for that. So
I had questions about that as well, because he scans the surface of the planet and doesn't find anything. And Captain Janeway is like, well, and then he's like, oh, maybe they're underground. And I thought to myself, oh, maybe it's harder to scan underground. But it takes him no time to scan up to 3 kilometers and find everyone. So my thought was, why don't you just do that right off the bat?
Yes.
But it's not as dramatic. That's why I'm not a writer of a TV show, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, so then this is where we get my biggest problem. I can't let this go.
ooh, tell me.
Because rather than beaming down, like you said, they decide to beam the pods up. And this brings to me the question, how are they powered?
Because
wouldn't it unplug them from the wall if they transported them out? I just wanted a line. I wanted Tom Paris to say, can we transport them up? And somebody to say, no, idiot. That would unplug them from the wall. And then to have Harry Kim or somebody say, oh, the pods appear to be self-powered. I just wanted
that
line in there. Yeah. But because it's not there, I cannot let this go, Scott.
And it does seem to me very reckless to on a number of levels because, A, like you said, we don't know what the power source is.
Right.
So that's a risk. We don't know anything about the technology or what could be down there. So just bringing them up onto the ship also seems like a ridiculous risk when you could just send. So there are, well, I don't know how many people are on Voyager. I'm sure there's more than 500 or somewhere around there. So instead of, you know, sending five people down to the planet and you risk them, and if they all die, that's sad. But if everyone on Voyager dies, that's, you know, worse.
Yes.
So
now Janeway did ask, are there any booby traps? Which I guess that the scanning, while being able to go below ground, also can detect booby traps.
Of course. And so that's one of the first scans you do. You scan the surface, you scan for booby traps. If you don't find any, then you scan underground.
Yes, it's on the universal sensor checklist.
That's right. But yeah, so they bring them up. I will say, I did think it was ridiculous that they beamed them up, but I do like the look of the five stasis units. I think they look cool.
Yes, they definitely do.
And we know that there are five of them. This is my other question. So there's 400,000 people on this planet.
Yes. What is their plan?
And now there are five people left, and that's their plan to just save five people who will then wake up 15 years later and rebuild the entire planet by themselves?
Yeah, I don't think that the breeding program is going to be a lot of fun for anybody.
No, it seems like it was perhaps not well thought out. And maybe they're just, you know, because they were rushing. But if they were rushing, one wonders, why did they have this weird stasis system ready before the solar flare?
Yeah.
A lot of questions.
Yeah, so there's a lot of little bits of logic in this episode that are not logical.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, other than that.
Other than, as long as you don't think too deeply about the very premise of the episode, it's fine.
Well, that's the trouble with watching it a couple times in preparation. You start to see the holes.
Only watch them once. That's what you should do. And that's what normal people do. And so I like the design of the stasis pods. I did know, because we knew that there are three people who are alive in the pods and two people who are dead. And so I knew there's a scene where Janeway goes into the cargo hold and she, you know, does the thing that you always do with stasis pods, which is wipe away the condensation and the frost to look in.
And the dust.
And you see a person and they seem fine. And then she says, well, I have to do another one. And so she goes and does another one. And I knew, well, of course, this one's going to have a corpse in it.
Yes.
And it did.
It was reminiscent of the Planet of the Apes. The original movie.
Yes.
Where they have the one pod that goes bad. Mm-hmm. Now, my question here is, though, these are stasis pods, right?
Yes.
And they're in working order.
Mm-hmm.
So even if someone died in one, it would seem like they would be preserved much better than this corpse was.
Yes, because the light is on, right? So it seems like it's working, except that, and we know, spoiler alert, the people who died because of fright and massive heart attacks. We're going to talk about it. That's what happens.
Maybe the pod detects that there's a lack of a heartbeat anymore and just goes, well, okay, no point. Go ahead and shut down. Preserve power.
Because they're self-powered, as we know.
Exactly. Yes. Here, we solved it.
There you go. That's why it is. Yeah. So we got three alive people, two dead people. Everybody is trying to figure out what happens. And they scan it and they realize, oh, not only are these stasis pods, but they are networked together.
Right.
And they are providing, the computer is not only monitoring their vitals, but, you know, streaming data into their brains. And this leads everyone to think, or maybe Janeway says, maybe they're, you know, actively using their brains in some kind of simulation or something to keep them, you know, lively, which is an interesting idea.
Yeah. And it's 3 years before the Matrix.
That's right.
Whoa. Cool idea.
Yeah. Speaking of Keanu Reeves, he's coming up so much. The Matrix is a better movie than the Day of the Earth Stood Still remake. So watch The Matrix instead.
But I agree. Yes.
Just stop at The Matrix, though. Don't watch the rest of them.
Also agree.
So stasis pods, they're not just stasis pods. They're a computer. And now we're finding all this out, and it makes it even more reckless of a decision to beam these people up because they had no idea how any of this worked anyway. But now suddenly it's on the Starship.
Yes.
But now Janeway does what any good manager does when you are confronted with a problem. She calls a meeting and she gets everybody in a room and she's like, we need to figure out what to do.
Yes. And this is where they figure out that they should have woken up mm-hmm. 4 years ago. And there's an automatic out built in basically to show them the status of the planet. Which and I then they should just be able to go, okay, and we're done now.
And I thought it was a good detail. I think that this episode has some good details. Yes. I like that, you know, little alert that says, you know, maybe in 15 years, the planet's not okay. So let's build this subroutine that tells us every once in a while, you know, gives us the right. update on the planet. That's a good idea. Mm-hmm. And this is where we find out that the two dead people didn't die because of some kind of malfunction in the system, but they had massive heart attacks caused by stress, but we don't really know why. And that the doctor, they can't just turn it off and you know, defrost these people because they don't really know how it works. And the doctor is concerned that they will cause neurological damage if they do that.
Right. You can't just pull the plug when somebody's in the Matrix.
That's right. And so they're like, well, how the heck are we going to get them out? We don't even know why they won't come out. And Tuvok, with his migraine, says, why don't we just ask the colonists? And everyone's like, what? Which, yes. You know, this is the problem with, I think, any TV show, that the characters are as smart or as dumb as the story requires. And it yes. seemed pretty obvious to me what Tuvok was suggesting, but everybody else in the room did not seem to understand.
Yeah.
And so basically,
let's just get the pods out and send a couple people in.
Exactly. And that's what they do. So B'Elanna and Harry Kim are chosen to get podded in and see what the heck is going on.
Yes.
And I don't really know why those two were chosen. Well, I guess B'Elanna's an engineer and Harry Kim likes to go into pods. I don't know.
Because it's a Harry Kim episode.
That's right. He's contractually obligated to have his episode. Yes.
But we need him down there to give unnecessary exposition at some point.
That's right. And this is when they decide, oh, we have a subroutine of our own. So if you can't get out for whatever reason, like, we don't know why these people are stuck, but we want to give you an out. So in 5 minutes, you will automatically be summoned to leave the system.
Yes.
And I guess it requires user interaction to actually leave. So it doesn't actually kick you out. It's basically like a little prompt that says, would you like to log out of the virtual simulation?
Yeah, I do have some additional questions about how they were able to modify the code without shutting it down.
You know, I don't know. They have a very good compiler and I don't know.
It's hot swappable kernels, I guess.
Software injection or something. They found a form on a web server that was a couple of versions out of date.
They found a security exploit. Yes.
That's right. And so they, Torres and Harry Kim get in the pods with the help of Kes, who doesn't really do much in this episode either, except scan some people. And yes. Suddenly they are in a strange new world.
It drops them right into Cirque du Soleil.
That's right, where people are cavorting and they're wearing all kinds of leotards and I don't know. This strikes me as something so achingly Star Trek-y. Yes. This setting.
it reminded me of a TOS episode yes. in a lot of ways.
That's right. They are dropped into a TOS episode, I think, is what yeah. is happening.
Pretty much.
It's like a weird cavernous room that has some kind of alien geometric hangings. Everybody's wearing skin-tight uniforms and masks and yes. cavorting.
And doing rhythmic gymnastics. They've yes. got the ball thing and the streamer.
It's just kind of odd.
yeah.
And they're looking, and none of them, the important thing to note is that, so we've seen, or at least Harry Kim and B'Elanna have seen the three people that are in the pods, so they're looking for those people.
Yes.
And none of these wacky cavorting people are those people. And they all seem kind of friendly, a little off kilter perhaps, but friendly.
Yes.
And they're saying we're looking for friends, and they come across a little person and who Harry Kim seems delighted to meet. And she asks where you're from, and B'Elanna Torres says we're from another town, and that's apparently the wrong answer because there are no right. other towns. And
no, there are not.
Things get a little tense. And Harry Kim says we're looking for help, and one of the odder people who is like a on stilts and kind of dressed as like a specter of death says, maybe I can help you.
Yeah, he was like an extra from the creepiest version of Sesame Street.
Yes, he's kind of like if a Snuffleupagus cross with the Grim Reaper.
Yeah, or the Demogorgon from Stranger Things.
That's right. There's weird things happening in this episode. And then suddenly everybody gets upset, right? And then they want to try and kill Harry Kim with a pink guillotine for some reason.
Yeah.
And
this is when we meet the clown, right?
Is this when the clown comes in? Yes. Who I like. I like Michael McKean a lot actor. I'm not sure. I don't know how I feel about the clown as a character.
Yeah, I think it starts off a little rough at the beginning. He's being a little too jovial in places, but mm-hmm. He does warm to it. And there's parts later where I think his performance is really, really good. Kind of chiefly when he's interacting with the doctor.
Yes, yes. And we'll get to that because that's the best part, I feel like, because he – well, we'll get to it. So he, mm-hmm. the clown, is clearly in charge, right? And he says, I guess what – Harry Kim is like, we're looking for friends. And the clown is like, we're all friends here, so you're in luck. But then he gets upset and he starts – and they do a lot of interesting and one assumes cheap but still effective kind of cuts to show that the clown can kind of move around and move, has control over the environment, right? So mm-hmm. people are like dancing and cavorting, and then they cut and the clown is standing there and everybody's like lined up behind him. And I thought it was effective at showing kind of his mastery of the environment without having to use a whole bunch of special effects.
Yes.
So I also appreciated that of this episode. I don't want to be too down on it before people who love this episode tell me why I'm wrong. now this is when we get the clown. He seems kind of creepy because he's a clown. So right off the bat.
Yes. And then you have a guillotine, which kind of completes the nightmare for me.
That's right. And so then, but it's pink and it's got, which is a nice color, I think. And then it's got this weird executioner who apparently just needs to push a button and who will chop your head off. And he's going to cut off Harry Kim's head. And then they don't do – oh, the people, the actual yes. aliens show up.
The people they were looking for.
And they're like, hey, don't do that.
Yeah, if you do that, then you don't know what his people are like. And
that's right. Harry Kim is saved by the aliens. And we find out through a number of scenes that the aliens designed the system that they're in to learn, basically, and adapt to their needs. And as they were – kind of trapped in it, or they're not really trapped because they put themselves in here, but then they do become trapped. The computer was learning from them and learning basically that they were afraid of things and picking up on that. And then it kind of created this character of the clown that personifies fear. And then the clown just kind of took over and has basically trapped them in here and won't let them leave.
Right.
And will basically terrorizes them, and he has killed the other two people that have died, not by physical means, but by putting them in this guillotine and basically making them so afraid that they have heart attacks.
Yes.
And so now our beloved Harry Kim and B'Elanna are held hostage because the clown doesn't want to leave him, and he wants more brains because that's the way this computer works. It is powered by brains, and if it doesn't have brains – it won't work.
Yeah, this is where you get the unnecessary exposition from Harry Kim when the clown says, look, if you guys all leave, then we cease to exist, which I thought was very, very clear. And then Harry Kim more or less restates the exact same thing.
Well, I want to make sure that the slower people in the audience will understand.
Maybe so.
And the problem is, so you think, well, Harry Kim is smart and B'Elanna is smart, so they can clearly get their way out of it. But the problem is, of course, that the computer is powered by their brain, but it also has all access to their memories and what they're thinking. And so that is how I think a very effective scene where the clown basically goes through a bunch of fears of Harry Kim kind of normal fears that we all have growing old, having to rely on other people to take care of you, being thought of as the baby of the crew, which is effective for Harry Kim. But those are not his real fears. And so Harry Kim is feeling a little cocky. He's like, you know, you don't really know what scares me. But then the clown, in fact, does know. And he's like, well, I didn't want to do this in front of everyone, Harry Kim, but you forced my hand. And he, in a very kind of visceral scene, I feel like he straps him to this hospital bed and recounts this memory that Harry Kim has that clearly is his deepest fear.
Yes.
So I like that. And that's, I think that's the point at which the clown as a character starts working for me.
Yes.
Because he's creepy.
And that's right when the doctor comes in, actually, during that scene.
And the clown doesn't know what to do with the doctor.
No. And I mean, we skipped over, of course, trying to speed up the recap a little bit, but that Janeway is talking back on the ship. I think this is after they let B'Elanna go.
Yes, they let B'Elanna go to tell people what's going on and basically tell his demands, the clown. And Janeway, of course, wants to save Harry Kim. And so she's trying to figure out a way. How do you negotiate with the fear as an emotion?
Yes. I think it's interesting that she says we need to reduce the number of hostages, which does happen, but not in the way I think she would prefer.
That's true, because one of the aliens dies. He gets his head chopped off, and mostly because the clown wants to prove a point that he will do it. And then they decide to send in the doctor, because the doctor has no emotions, I guess, and he can try to negotiate with the clown. The clown is not really a good faith negotiator.
No, and he asks, right, how can I negotiate with you if I can't tell what you're thinking? And I did like the line from the doctor, I have a very trustworthy face.
Yes.
It was well delivered.
Robert Picardo can deadpan. He has a bunch of deadpan delivery in this episode, which is very effective. And I do like when he's introduced, the clown is about to cut open Harry Kim with the scalpel, and the doctor says, you're holding the scalpel wrong here. Let me show you how to hold the scalpel. I like
yes.
that. So there's lots of back and forth, and basically they need to figure out a way to, trick or beat fear at its own game, right? And so Janeway, one assumes, comes up with this, and I'm just skipping to the end of the episode. Janeway comes up with this interesting idea where she basically says, hey, the clown, if you release all the prisoners, your hostages, I will give you myself as a hostage. And the clown is like, well, that sounds pretty good. And so he does.
It's a very captain thing to do, right?
It is. And even more so, a very Starfleet captain thing to do, because she basically tricks him. By having them modify the machinery to monitor her brain, but they project a simulation of her into the computer. So the clown thinks she's there, but she's not.
Yeah, it's exploiting what was introduced earlier, the fact that there's the delay between when you think something and when he picks up on it.
Right.
Chekhov's delay, I guess.
That's right. And so he doesn't know for a couple of minutes that she's a simulation, and it dawns on him that she is a simulation, and she basically, he's talking about, how could you defeat me? I'm fear. And she says, well, I think you'll find that Starfleet captains are not afraid of fear. The only reason you exist is because you want to be conquered. And I think that you actually let me do this because you know yourself that you want to end your existence. And this is the ending, like the last minute of this episode is so great, because he's been terrorizing everybody, and suddenly he knows that he's been outwitted and that he's going to die, basically. And they slowly lower the lights, and he whispers to her, basically, I'm afraid. And she says, I know.
I know.
And then it just ends.
It doesn't just end though, Scott. I rewatched it, and he says, right before the episode ends, he says, drat.
Oh.
To me, it completely, I mean, it doesn't ruin it, but like it was perfect before that. And then he drops that in there, and I just thought, what?
It would be better without the drat.
Yeah.
I think an I know with an end, because I was expecting, once again, this is the first time I've seen this episode, I was expecting him to die, and then we go back to Voyager, and everybody's happy. But just cutting to black and saying drat, apparently, and then rolling the credits, very effective.
I thought it was a great ending. I did kind of want it to go. Have you ever read I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream?
I have not.
By Harlan Ellison.
I have not read.
So I do recommend it. It's kind of creepy, but this is very reminiscent of it. And it reminded me strongly of it while I was watching it. And I thought we might have like a Black Mirror ending, but that's not really the way Star Trek does things. So
no, this is a pretty unusual, I feel like, ending for Star Trek as it is.
It is.
Because I feel like normally what happens is people are imperiled, they solve the problem, and then we get kind of a celebratory scene at the end or like some kind of thought-provoking, like, we were the true monsters all along kind of thing. But I guess at the end we do see Janeway has outwitted someone, so that's kind of a normal thing.
Like you said, I mean, it really is a good ending. It's a great moment for Janeway. It's really, really well delivered on both of their parts. And I do like the fact that it becomes kind of smaller in terms of the way it's directed, where the light begins to fall and it centers in on them. It's really effective.
And they're standing very close to one another. I think that's, like I said at the beginning of this episode, this is the Thaw is certainly not my favorite Voyager episode, but it's certainly not a bad episode.
No. In fact, I, you know, by way of kind of final thoughts on this one, I did enjoy it. I enjoyed it quite a bit, especially the second time. Even though I was nitpicking it in a few places, more than a few places, the power of that ending is enough to kind of put this on the, okay, that's a good episode. And I do, like you said, I like the fact that they went for something here. It's not just another episode. It is very much the Thaw. And it's not like, I mean, I'm speaking from a lot of ignorance here, but I'm assuming most Voyager episodes are not at all like this one.
No. This is an unusual episode, and they were going for it. And I think that, you know, whenever you go for it, you're taking a risk, and they took risks in this episode. And not every risk pays off in this episode, certainly. But overall, I think it works. And so I will say thumbs up to this episode.
And I'll say, as somebody who hasn't watched much Voyager, I was always a little turned off by Janeway's voice, and it's really shallow. But her performance here, especially at the end, makes me think, okay, this is an interesting character that I need to check more out about.
Yes, Janeway. I mean, I was very much in the same camp as you. Her voice kind of threw me off, and I thought part of it, I mean, it's just her Kate Mulgrew's voice, so that's just what it is.
What are you going to do?
Part of me thought that they were trying to make her sound more like a man. And so that made me not like it, because I wanted, you know, she's a woman and she should be a woman. And obviously she sounds the way she does. So that was really me projecting on her, not anything other than that. So the fault was, I was the true monster all along. but as I watched more and more Voyager, I have come to really look at Janeway as one of the best characters in Star Trek, because she is certainly a far better captain than Captain Kirk ever was, just from kind of like an operational standpoint.
Sure.
She comes from like her science officer background. So you could see, you know, Kate Mulgrew does a great job of, you can see the sparkle in her eyes when she is seeing something unknown, which kind of makes me understand why they would just randomly beam this thing up, because Janeway is just so excited to try to figure it out. It's still a bad decision, I think, but.
Yeah, I think if they had had an away mission, it would have added too much to the runtime, and they couldn't have spent as much time in the Clowns universe.
Yes. So. And I feel like, not that I'm not an expert on TV production or budgets, but I feel like they probably spent most of their budget on the Clowns room and all of the extras, and they couldn't afford another set. So it was like, we're using this set and the cargo bay we already have, and let's go.
Yep.
And so that's why they beamed it up, people.
Yep.
So this is your third Voyager experience, and it sounds like overall it was a positive one.
It was a positive one, and I'm the primary cook in my house, and I'm always looking for something to watch on Netflix while I'm cooking. So, you know, this could be it. Who knows?
Yeah, you should check out one of the episodes. Is a two-parter that I recommend to people. Is Year of Hell, which is a fantastic two-parter of Voyager. So if you just want to kind of jump around, I would suggest watching that two-parter. And then if you like that, you should jump in and watch some Voyager.
Nice.
But, well, Seth, thank you so much for joining me and talking about Star Trek.
Well, Scott, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure was all mine.